This is the TriDot Podcast. TriDot uses your training data and genetic profile combined with predictive analytics and artificial intelligence to optimize your training, giving you better results in less time with fewer injuries. Our podcast is here to educate, inspire, and entertain. We'll talk all things triathlon with expert coaches and special guests. Join the conversation and let's improve together.
Welcome to the TriDot Podcast. This is the start of a three-week series where we aim to solve your 10 biggest swim problems, your 10 biggest bike problems, and your 10 biggest run problems. And boy, oh boy, do I have the right coaches here to act as our senseis in the swim. Our first coach joining us today is Will Usher. Will is the head coach and founder of the Precision Race team, a top-ranked team in the European rankings. Formerly a captain in the Royal Military Elite Close Protection Unit, Will has been coaching triathlon for over 20 years. He's competed in over 200 triathlons and duathlons, ranging from local events to world championships. Still competing, his current focus is Ironman and Ironman 70.3. And most importantly for this conversation, Will, your background is in the swim. So thanks so much for coming on to talk about it.
Yeah, hi, thanks very much. Great to be here again. Really looking forward to talking all things swimming, which, as you say, is actually where my sporting life began. So, it's a bit of a home point for me.
Also with us is Coach Joanna Namy. Joanna is better known as Coach JoJo and has been coaching athletes with TriDot since 2012. She's a co-founder of Hissy Fit Racing, a member of the Betty Design Elite Squad, and has double-digit Ironman finishes on her accomplished triathlon resume. She's a two-time Kona qualifier and is racing on the Big Island for a second time here actually very, very shortly at the point this episode goes out. As our director of TriDot Pool School, her passion is getting athletes faster and more comfortable in the water. Coach Joe, I love swimming. How about you?
I love swimming. I would rather swim every day than run one more step in my life. Everybody knows that. And I'm glad to be here with Will. Haven't seen him in a while, so this is going to be awesome.
I am Andrew, the average triathlete, voice of the people, and captain of the middle of the pack. As always, we'll roll through our warm-up question, settle in for our main set conversation, and then wind things down with our cool down. We are over the moon excited to partner with RaceQuest for a new initiative we are calling TriDot Trips. RaceQuest specializes in endurance sport race travel, camps, and experiences, and they will be helping us put on multiple top-notch trips for the TriDot family in 2024 and beyond. At every TriDot trip, you can expect totally rad training opportunities, clinics with our coaches, special guest presentations, and so much more. All set in picturesque, train-cation-worthy destinations. For 2024, we have five opportunities to train and race with other TriDotters on the schedule. For 2024, the locations are Boulder, Asheville, Roth, Kona, and Costa Rica. Lots of great stuff. So head to race-quest.com and click on TriDot to check out all of these options. The password for that webpage is TriDot in all capital letters. And of course, reach out to the team at RaceQuest for more information. And by the way, you can reach out to RaceQuest if you are interested in their help to plan the travel for your own triathlon trip as well.
Time to warm up. Let's get moving.
Different strokes for different folks definitely applies to triathlon gear. We all have our preferences for what we like and dislike in our stuff. As we shop, we all know certain features we have to have in our gear, and we all know certain features that are total deal breakers for us in a piece of gear. So, Joe, Will, for our warm-up question today, what is a feature in a piece of gear that just ruins it for you? You will not buy it with this feature. Joanna, what do you think?
Twofold. One plays into nutrition. Anything coffee-flavored is a heck no. I can't stand coffee nor the flavor. Secondly, this is going to play into what you say, Andrew, but built-in sports bra into a top. That is a no-no for a tall woman. That becomes a midriff in about 5 seconds. So the answer is no on that.
Okay, yep. Yeah, two great answers. If you see that, it is a no-go for you. You're just simply not going to buy it. I like coffee-flavored gels myself. And so, again, this plays into the idea that something that works great for me and that I enjoy is a total deal-breaker for Coach Joe. Will, what's your answer here?
Yeah, okay, so it's not really a feature, but latex swim hats. Like, we have moved on. You know, latex swim hats were done by the early 90s, but you still see them at races. I'm like, come on, man. You know, you spend maybe 3 cents on this thing, and it tears apart as soon as you put it on. Like, swim hats been around, let's stick with that. But otherwise, I guess products and brands on the market that are selling poorly researched gear. I can't be too specific about this story, but there was a very large international meet, a gathering of countries, shall we say, one of the medical staff was finding this same injury in a lot of their athletes and a lot of their sprinters and in their middle and their long distance runners. And they're like, okay, what's the common denominator? And what they said was it was this shoe, right? They all had this new shoe that was issued to the team. Great. And what they found out about this shoe is the medical guy phoned the rep up and said, what's new, what have you done? And he said, well, what we've done is we've looked at a gazelle and we've seen how they've run and we've applied it to the shoe. And so the medical professional goes, cool, you know a gazelle's knee points backwards, right? And there's just silence on the other end of the phone. And it just,
what a miss.
Nearly knackered an entire team's opportunities on an international stage. But anyway, so they quickly changed the shoe after that and discontinued it. But yeah, so poorly researched gear.
Yeah, so some marketing guy thought that sounded really cool and just didn't think about the application for the athletes. But yeah, I agree. In the swim caps, you know, these days, the latex ones, they pull at your hair. They're tighter on the head. Silicone ones, if you can get one, they're not that much more expensive, and your head will be happier for it. This answer for me, it is a total deal breaker when a pair of running shorts has a brief liner. I know I am the anomaly here. I know for pure runners, especially, standard top of the line run shorts all have brief built-in liners for men. For me, it, absolutely not. It doesn't do nearly enough to secure the things I want secured. I'll just put it that way. I feel way too loosey-goosey in any brief liner I've ever tried. I really like kind of compression liners that go a little bit further down the leg, keep everything a little bit more in place. And so I go out of my way to buy shorts that have that built in. A lot of like gym shorts have that. Not too many running brands have really, really good run shorts with a compression kind of trunk liner. And I had a brand that I really liked, and all of a sudden they went out of business and they stopped selling them. And so I very, very recently stumbled upon a new brand that has a phenomenal a proper run short with a longer, more compression liner. The brand is called Bandit Running. Brand new brand. I have a couple pairs of their shorts now, and just a brilliant compression liner. A lot of trail shorts, honestly, for brands that are putting out trail running materials, have longer liners and not the brief liners. And so I really look to those to keep everything in its proper place. The brief liners is just an absolute not for me. Moving on from me alluding to that one more time, I want to hear what the Tridot family has to say about this. So make sure you're a member of the I Am Tridot Facebook group. I'm going to ask you this question. What is a feature and a piece of gear that when you see this, it's just absolutely not, I will not buy it, does not work for me? I can't wait to see what you have to say.
On to the main set. Going in 3, 2, 1.
Tridot Pool School is the best way for triathletes to learn proper swim form. The Tridot coaching team spent years on the pool deck crafting functional freestyle, and it has already helped hundreds of triathletes improve their swim by an average of 12%. As soon as an athlete registers for Tridot Pool School, they are given access to the Tridot Academy, where a series of dry land exercises help build crucial muscle memory long before the in-person weekend. The weekend workshop is an engaging blend of instruction, demonstrations, and drills, with frequent breaks to rest and reflect. You'll be grouped with swimmers of similar ability and taught step-by-step how to turn your muscle memory into full-stroke swimming that's smooth and fast. Tridot Pool School is for everyone. We've had entry-level triathletes, back-of-the-packers, mid-packers, some elite age groupers, and even a couple of pro triathletes attend. Ready to jump in? There are pool schools available all over the country and around the world. Head to tryout.com/pool-school and sign up today. I had some swim talking points already lined up for this discussion, but just to make sure we were hitting the biggest issues that you, our athletes, actually face, I threw a post out to the I Am Tryout Facebook group asking our athletes, what do you think is your biggest problem in the swim? There were loads of great responses. In less than 2 days, it had over 100 responses to this question of people very, very quick to tell me what their biggest problem was. So I'm excited for us to help out some folks today. I tried to capture what you said in your posts in these 10 problems we're going to work through and solve today. So Will, Joe, let's solve some swim problems. Big swim problem number one is getting in the pool. This is 100% a problem for me. I procrastinate going down to the pool so hard. So I'm glad other tri-daughters were reporting that this is an issue for them. Coaches, you know, give us tips, you know, for getting our butts down to the pool and getting our butts in the pool without faffing about too much. Will Usher, what do you have for us here?
I hear this quite a lot, actually. It's not an enormous surprise. 85% of triathletes don't come from a swim background. You would think that would make them hungry to learn, but actually sometimes quite
it doesn't. No.
One of the best ways, I think, to get down to the consistent, if you have the time that you can do it and you have the friends that can do it at the same time, is to get a friend to go with you and agree to meet them there. But go tech free, go 90s, go 80s even. Right, because it's too easy. You can only allowed to contact each other in an emergency, and so you know that if you're not there, you're letting that person down. Right?
Because wow.
Equally, if it's somebody who also doesn't really like swimming, maybe you know, because you've just made it a whole lot harder for them. So that's pretty a good way to do it. But I'd appreciate that a lot of people swim on their own. So things like prep is super important. You know, sort out all your gadgets, your various swim toys, and stow them all in one place. Have your bottles ready. Your goggles. There's no procrastination time, right? Because although, you know, most of the swims are only like an hour long, it's the stuff for and after that.
Absolutely.
It's the logistics of it. It's a lot harder than popping out for a run. So yeah, that really helps. What else? I mean, one thing that I think people forget is, and particularly this is one for the runners and cyclists, right, is that actually the swim has a direct impact on your capacity to compete in the triathlon itself. And like one of the reasons for this is the deep core, right? So if we, let's take the example of throwing a javelin, right? And you might ever, or when you're throwing a baseball or whatever, you hear the expression being thrown from the feet, and it comes through, transfers power from your legs through your core into your arm. That's great. In swimming, you don't have that fixed platform, right? The fixed platform is your core. That's how you're able to generate power from your arms. And what happens is an intermediate triathlete will do a stroke a meter, roughly. So on an Ironman, broadly 4,000 strokes, there's about 6,000, six different muscle groups that get involved in swimming. So in an Ironman swim, you're talking about 24,000 reps. Right? That's not something that you're going to do in the gym in about an hour, right? It's just not going to be there. So you need to be swim strong and not just gym strong. But because of that, that deep core strengthening, it will really help your run. It'll help the bike as well, help your positioning on the bike, but it massively help your run. And you can always tell the pure runners who have struggled through the swim and blown up their core in the swim, and they can't compete in or do nearly as well in their best discipline, and they're sort of slightly bent over running along the run course because their core's collapsed and they can no longer transfer power from the upper body to the lower body. So, you know, think about the big picture. The juice is worth the squeeze.
For me, I found keeping a race on the calendar really helps with this. If I have races on the calendar, even if it's C races, local sprints, and Olympics, like I'm much less likely to skip going down to the pool because I've got to swim in a race soon. And if I don't have a race on the calendar, man, it can get real easy to allow myself to skip a swim once a week or something like that. Coach Joe, what is your advice for your athletes on getting yourself in the pool to get that swim set done?
I'd say great minds think alike, as Will and I had two exactly the same. You know, I talk about with my athletes, swim partner, and like reaching out, make a friend, your swim friend. You'll be much more accountable. And secondly, night prep, like he discussed. But lastly, bribery. I do this with all of my athletes. You set a prize for the end of the week. You have to do this. It's a bargaining game with yourself. Do you want that purse? Do you want that purse? Do you want to get a massage on Monday? You can only have it if you go to the pool twice this week.
Okay.
And it really works for athletes. I mean, we have to turn ourselves into children. And like, do you want the candy? Do you want the candy? You have to go to the pool. Okay.
Big swim problem number two is our legs. Our stupid, good-for-nothing legs. Many people say their legs sink and it causes poor body position on the swim. Others have a weak kick that just doesn't do very much to propel them forwards. Coaches, how can we get our legs up and kicking productively during our swim? Coach Joe, you first on this one.
Well, you know, this is interesting because, you know, we what Will referred to is that, you know, 85% of people did not come from a swim background, and they were, you know, we call early on, is it early onset swimmers? No, that's not right.
Late onset swimmers.
That's what it
delayed.
Is. Delayed.
Adult onset swimmers.
Yeah, and in doing that, you know, most triathletes don't know what proper kick is. It's not something they incorporate into their swim workouts every day. No one has taught them that, you know, you're supposed to have a tiny micro kick. You know, I use the reference from when I taught kids swim lessons that you're kicking in a shoebox. Those feet cannot come outside this shoebox. And so having my athletes, you know, or some of the attendees for pool school, teaching them to have that tiny micro kick and where their feet are going to be in the water, that their, you know, heels are going to peek out. And so it's, you know, I always ask my athletes to incorporate about 100 to 200 meters of kicking with a kickboard into warm up and to listen for that rapid boiling water sound from a kick. If we can get your feet where they're supposed to be and doing what they're supposed to be doing, which is create propulsion, they're going to be much more, you know, set to have proper body position and balance in the water.
Yeah, and that's kind of why I group these two together as the problem being our legs, because, you know, sinking legs and poor kick often go hand in hand. I know for me, I have horrible, like, hand-eye-foot coordination. And so for me, in my swim sets, even if TriDot doesn't have a kicking drill in my warm-ups, I almost always do some form of just 100, 200, a little bit of kicking in the start of my swim set, just to kind of remind myself, like, hey, think about your kick. Stay intentional with your kick. Because if I'm not, I'll get halfway through a swim workout and realize I'm not even kicking unless I kind of give myself that reminder early on in a set. So I totally relate to this when people are reporting this problem. Coach Will, what do you say to people when it comes to our stupid legs not being in the right spot and doing something to help us swim forwards?
Head position is everything, right? It's the cheapest way to bring your hips up or your legs up, and it's really important to do. Swimming is a function of maximizing propulsion and minimizing drag. So your body position and balance is key. So your head is up, it means your hips are down, and you're creating a huge amount of frontal drag. But if you get your head down, your hips will come up, and you remove that frontal drag pretty quickly. It's actually the theory behind some wetsuits out there. They have a thicker 5 mil around the legs and a 3 mil on the chest. They actually used to have more lift on the chest, but of course that exacerbates the problem. And actually, it's much more important to have you in that balanced position. I think also something to, Joe alluded to there, but remember, a weak kick doesn't need to be an inefficient kick, right? It takes a lot of time and practice. Long-term runners, actually, the more running they've done, the more weight-bearing stuff they've done, the more fused their ankle is and less flexible their ankle is. And to some point in running, you want that degree of inflexibility to create this sort of spring effect. So there is a balance to be met, but the kicking that you should be doing should be efficient. And look, don't expect to hit a 6 beat, like fast sprinter's leg kick the whole time. Like even Olympic swimmers on a 200 meter swim rarely hit a full 6 beat leg kick for the full 200 meters, right? Just 200. They'll do it on the first and last 50,
wow.
But in between they'll have a 4 beat efficient stabilizing kick. Okay, so something to practice. And to say, it doesn't need to be necessarily fast, but it can be efficient and help stabilize you.
Big swim problem number three is breathing. Yeah, we need to breathe. This is a crucial thing in every sport, especially swimming when our face is down in the water. Some athletes asked about how often we should be breathing, how many strokes every other, you know, bilateral, 3 strokes, 4 strokes. Others asked how to breathe more smoothly to where you're not interrupting your stroke as you're coming out of the water for that breath. And a few athletes reported always feeling out of breath by the end of their intervals. So coaches, solve our breathing problems for us. Pretty please and thank you. Coach Will.
Yeah, I agreed. Breathing is necessary. Apparently, we don't do too well without it. So I definitely recommend breathing while swimming.
Strong. 10 out of 10 recommend breathing while swimming.
Yeah, so there is a problem. And as humans, we're genetically programmed to hold our breath underwater. It's why you can take a young baby and hold them underwater safely in the knowledge that they won't try and breathe in for a time. You know, talking a few seconds here, wow. You know, don't try minutes at home, please. But anyway, as a consequence, people will often take a breath, but they'll hold it. And when they put their face back in the water, but then when they come to breathe again, they have to breathe out and in the time they previously had just to breathe in. Consequently, you'll start becoming hypoxic and or the stroke falls apart as you're rolling your head too far to try and get some more or extra time to breathe. So how do you fix that? I'd get used to being underwater and slowly breathing out. If you're relaxed, you should be able to, I call it, flap your lips, all right? And if you breathe out, you should basically be able to make your lips vibrate, hopefully. This has other benefits as well, which is sort of not tightening up the shoulder girdle and making sure that you're relaxed in the upper body. But the main thing is that you're relaxed, okay? Think about walking down the street. You don't walk down the street taking a breath in, holding it for 5 steps, and then quickly doing an in and an out. You want to replicate as close as possible your normal breathing in the water. And actually, you know, you can start by holding your breath for a little bit longer, like doing 6 strokes where you normally do 2. And as you become efficient with that process, you can drop it down because, you know, you have to speed it up and everything else. But, no, it is important to get a decent amount of air in. So when you're racing, you're looking at 2 to 3 strokes per breath. Try and make it as regular and as normal as walking down the street.
Okay. Yeah. Very, very helpful. And yeah, I just talking about trying to stay relaxed. When I first heard that, and I would try to apply that in my swim sets, it definitely makes a huge difference in a lot of areas. You know, breathing and form. If you can kind of get your body to relax into the water, not fight the water, work with the water. So great stuff there, Will. Joe, what do you tell your athletes when it comes to breathing in the swim?
Breathe more often. That is something, you know, my athletes and I are constantly working on form and proper stroke. I'm like, you have to be fully oxygenated. You cannot be deprived. You know, that heart rate goes up when you hold your breath. I like what Will was saying is that we are constantly breathing. We're constantly in some form of the process. So we take the inhale, but the moment that face goes back in the water, I tell them that this is what I told kids in swim lessons. Slow bubbles, blow those bubbles out, slow. See, I'll even have some of them practice humming as they blow out the bubbles because it makes them think of actions they have to do. And so they're not holding their breath. So that little bit of hum, blow out the bubbles, slow seep of bubbles, that works. I also tell athletes there's too much emphasis put on bilateral breathing. There's a lot of great things about bilateral breathing, but as you are working on your stroke and learning proper form, balance, body position, let's breathe. Let's breathe every stroke. If you are doing something where you are working on upper body or head position, as Will was talking about, put that snorkel on. And I know y'all hate them, but put it on. Take the breath out of the equation so you can breathe freely and be super relaxed. You know, you're not worrying about taking the breath, and then you can work on your stroke.
Big swim problem number 4 is trying to swim at the right speeds. This is usually a big problem for people when they come to structured training for the first time. And they're not just getting in the pool and clocking laps anymore. Just not knowing, you know, what each zone should feel like, or many people even reported just kind of having 1 or 2 speeds in the pool, not really having 3 or 4 different gears to swim at different zones. How can we get a better feel for different swim paces? Joe, over to you.
This is probably one of the number one questions that I get from athletes, you know, and how do I hit these zones? How do I hit my pacing? I don't know what the difference between zone 2 and zone 3, zone 4 feels like. And I'm going to take it way back. Like, we're going to go old school now, like really old school. I talk to my athletes about rate of perceived exertion. So I say, you know what all out feels like. That's 100%. That hurts. That's pain. That's, I can't, you know, I'm having trouble breathing. So when we talk about zones, I'll tell them zone 1, super easy. That's drilling. That's, you know, not focusing on any type of speed, just focusing on form. Zone 2, you know, we may be focusing on catch, pressure against the forearm, strong pull. When we get to zone 3, I always tell them 50% of all out. When I can give them a number of like what full exertion would feel like and only doing half that level, And then zone four. Okay, now you're about at 75% of all out. Five or six, go hard. And, you know, and putting it more into an RPE, rate of perceived exertion, you know, level of exertion really, I think, helps people understand what that's supposed to feel like.
For me, honestly, using a pull buoy initially as a chartered athlete really helped with that because it took, honestly, my sinking legs out of the equation. I could really get a feel for different paces. And then I kind of removed the pull buoy and got better at doing it with a full body. But over time, and you kind of have to relearn it. You know, if you take a long break from swimming, which I've done in certain seasons, and you get back in the pool, like for me, that's one of the first things to go, is that feel for different paces. And you kind of have to get that back again. And thankfully, it comes back faster each time you kind of get reacclimated to swimming in the pool. Coach Will, anything to add here on hitting our paces, you know, getting a feel for different paces in the pool?
Yeah, totally. I mean, sort of picking on what Joe was talking about there, like you'll notice those being diligent with their swim sessions on their Trident, on the Trident platform, you'll notice that there's some heart raises in there nearly always at the end of warm-up. And for ease, it's designed to say 450 descending 1-4. So the first one's easy, the last one's all in. Right? And you need to be able to create a clear change in pace with each one. And over time, you'd be able to align those to your different zones. But to practice, to start, just start really easy and make sure that each one has a clear definition of difference. And I think one of the other elements, actually, which can be a problem with is the watch. I recommend swimming without a watch and being much more present in the water. And so when you're relying on a watch for your timekeeping and everything else that goes with that, there is sometimes a bit of a tendency to zone out and let the technology do what it's going to do. Whereas if you are trying to swim at, say, RPE 7, and then you get a much better feel for, because you're totally dialed into how that's feeling, and then using the wall clock to do, you know, assimilate to line up that time. But I guess one of the biggest problems in terms of people swimming faster, or they feel like they can only have one sort of speed, is, you know, not reducing yourself to a chaotically splashing version of the Tasmanian devil, right?
sure.
And we use the idea of a speed limit, and that's the point at which you can still swim fast but hold on to your form. And if you do that repeatedly, you will get stronger in the right areas and the speed will come. If you thrash it inefficiently, you'll end up going the same speed or even slower.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, Will, because we did have a couple of athletes ask that specifically as a problem they have is, hey, I'm getting faster, I'm improving my form, I've been to Trident Pool School, but as soon as I try to go all out and as soon as I try to swim fast, all those bad habits of just flailing my arms, working too hard, not holding the right form, come back. And so that's a really, really interesting point there about kind of earning that speed, right? By just kind of, and over time, getting where you can push the speed faster and faster and maintain your form. That's a really interesting take there to kind of address a problem some people voice that I didn't necessarily have on my list of 10 here. So great stuff there. Big swim problem number 5 is translating pool speed to the open water. We do our Trident workouts, we see our fitness improve in the pool, and then we hit the open water and our paces are not what they are back in the pool. How do we fix this? Coach Will.
Many of you have seen in your programs doing like these bigger aerobic blocks, right, in the pool. It's super important because it helps you to gauge your speed and get used to that long, consistent swim that you're going to do on race day. But one of the sort of areas of specificity, I guess, for being in a pool but training for outdoor is your tumble or flip turns. You know, if you can learn how to do those, they're really useful because they exclude the micro recovery from a cardiovascular perspective. They also add a little bit of hypoxia to a session, which again only makes you more efficient ultimately in the water. And they're really not as hard to master as some might think. Don't, you know, I'm going to have thousands of tri-dotters around the world breaking their noses on the pool now. But it's really not that hard, right? Just keep it simple, and it's a good way to learn. But also remember that the very act of turning for most people, and this is to give some sort of context to swimming open water to in a pool, but the very act of turning for most people gives you a boost. Swimmers learn that you're at your fastest either off the block, off the start, or off the wall. and everything else is trying to slow down the deceleration from the wall, right? Of course, you know, you don't get that at open water. So, you know, bear that in mind. For example, converting a 100-meter swim time from a long course, 50-meter pool, or to a short course, 25-meter pool, set by FINA is 1.6 seconds over a 1 minute 30-100, right? So, and that's because there's two less turns. So if you take all the turns out, it's 2.4 seconds per 100. So over 3,800-meter swim, that's a minute 31 before you even factor in sighting, swimming straight, cold water, swimming in a bunch, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So, there's, you know, even if you were in a perfect scenario with no one around you, perfect, you're swimming down a lane line but outdoors, you're still going to be a minute 30 slower just because you're outdoors and there's no turns.
Yeah, that's great perspective, right? Just to, it's okay that you can't hold the same pace outdoors. There's more variables. There's everything you just said. You don't have the benefit of pushing off the wall every so often. The flip turns is interesting because it's come up on the podcast before. You know, some coaches feel strongly that if you can get it down, you should work it into your session. Some coaches don't value it as much. I at the moment have been doing an open turn. I'm interested in kind of getting the flip turn back into the rotation. I just haven't taken the time to really brush up on that skill. Coach Joe, what do you say here to athletes, in addition to what Will has said, about taking our pool speed and trying to get as much of that as we can out into the open water?
I think it comes down to, and I think you both will agree with me, is how comfortable we are in the open water. Is this our normal environment? I always relay it back to, if somebody put me on a gravel bike and put me in a gravel race, would I have the same speed? Is it the same environment? Is it the same conditions I have in the pool? We get in the habit of swimming, two, three times a week in the pool, never going out to open water, and then throw ourselves in the middle of an open water race and think we're going to do the same thing. Totally different environment, less comfortable. And what are we doing differently in the open water? Well, number one, now we can't see. If anybody has swam Ironman Texas, you can't see your hand in front of your face in the water. You know, and so now we're sighting, changing our body position, as Will referenced, you know, now we've got head up half the time, feet dragging, legs dragging, we stop kicking, all of it goes south quickly. You know, so honestly, if we want to maintain similar speed or increase our speed in open water, we have to get super comfortable. That has to become our norm. We need a lot of exposure. We need to be out there, you know, once a week. You know, a couple months leading up to our big race, you know, that's where we're going to have our most success, is if we've practiced in our wetsuit, if we've remembered that we're supposed to be kicking, if we master sighting. If that's not a possibility, if we don't have that availability, there are a number of drills that you can do in the pool to simulate being in the open water. But I have, as my athletes are approaching Kona right now, I have them doing sighting drills like mad women. In the pool, sighting something low on the deck, something high on the deck, becoming masters of that so that when they hit the water in Kona, you know, they have those skills to not lose full propulsion in the water every time they sight forward. So those are just some thoughts on it. You know, I always talk about being very comfortable in what you're doing, and you can't expect to maintain the same speeds or the same skills if you don't practice in that environment.
Big swim problem number six is not swimming the course straight on race day. And this very much goes hand in hand with kind of what Joe was just talking about, open water problems. A lot of factors can push us off course on race day, following the wrong person, currents, waves, poor sighting, poor form. Coaches, help us swim the course better, please, and thank you.
Yeah, sighting drills are super important. Practicing, you know, sighting if it's your local lake or wherever you're swimming, if it's an ocean swim, you know, picking a landmark on land that you can see and practicing seeing that, becoming more, you know, effective at sighting. And, you know, I tell my athletes, you know, even in your practicing, you know, in open water or in the pool, you may fail a couple times at getting a good sight, but that's okay. The more and more you practice it, the better you'll get. So as far as swimming straight, a lot of that has to do with form. A lot of that has to do with body position and hand entry. You know, I always demonstrate for my athletes that if you're moving your hands side to side, you're pushing your body side to side. You're not pushing your body forward. So it's very important, and we talk a lot about it in pool school, that the direction of how the hand enters, fingertips first, full reach and pulling directly back from overhead toward the hip in a straight motion. I talk about your railroad tracks that run alongside your body. Pulling that catch back, full acceleration toward the hip. It's going to propel you forward. It's not going to propel you left, 200 meters that's a lot, 200 meters to the side of a buoy. That might be off course. That but might be on land.
Some people go that far off.
It's amazing.
Have you ever been out there in open water and you look to the left and there's somebody just way out there?
No, the best
is, how did that person get out there?
The best is somebody swimming horizontal. Like, they're going right in front of you, the complete wrong direction. I can tell you, their hand entry must be off.
Yeah, I found for me, Joe, in the open water, when I am bilateral breathing, I tend to stay pretty straight. Will, what do you have to add here about just helping people stay straighter and not having their Strava file after a race look like a zigzagged mess?
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, it's a real problem. We do this drill to really highlight to swimmers how important it is to swim down the railroad tracks. Actually, the example we use is something that Alexander Popov, who is a multiple freestyle world record holder, used to say. It's like swim down a pipe, right? So you can't swing out to the outside. So all the physics are going front and back. And that really helps. But we do this drill where we black out or give people some blacked out goggles.
Wow.
And set them off into the lake and see what happens. They have to do 30 strokes, 40 strokes, whatever. Anyway, twice I've had people swim all the way back to the deck. Right? They've done a full circle, which is incredible. and the look of shock and awe on their face when they take the goggles off and go, what? So a nice little drill just to see quite how badly you are going to one side or not. Anyway, recce, though, a lot of issues that can be found in open water. If you do a good recce of the race site, if you can get in before race day, great. Not always possible because, you might be working right up to the end of it or whatever. You can get in and feel the temperature, the salt, and it's the first time you swim in the sea, all that good stuff. Hopefully you've done it before, but that's not always the case, but then also don't worry if you don't have time for this. Sometimes race sites, the water's pretty cold. It's not necessary for you to endure that more than you have to. And actually, whilst checking out the waypoints from the water is ideal, you can get a lot done from the land. You can designate landmarks or permanent features. If you're on a lake swim, you can walk to where the buoy is going to be and see what you're going to see on race day and look through the sight of the buoy. Make sure you're using permanent features. Don't use the third pigeon from the right. It might not be there on race day. And this is going to help you to sort of navigate in the heat of battle. But think about different ways of sighting, right? So, crocodile sighting is best, where you're just sort of peeping up. You're not going into a full sort of water polo stroke, you're just peeping and then going back into your normal stroke. But remember, you don't have to sight forwards. You can sight sideways as well. A lot of races around us are done in rowing lakes, which are nice and straight. But if you know that you are remaining equidistant to the bank, breathing on that side, then you're probably swimming straight. Right, and that could be the same, even in a sea swim, right? Orcas is a good example of this, where from Google Maps, right, you can map recce this, you don't even have to do it in real life. You know that there's a road that runs along the front, and you can tell that the road is there when you're in the water because you see the streetlights, or there's a bunch of palm trees or whatever that are lining that road. So you know that if they're kept equidistant, you are swimming straight with the course. Think about it from a reconnaissance perspective, and that will really help.
Will, the number one thing I took away from what you said is I have a new idea for our YouTube channel where we absolutely need to get a handful of our tryout coaches in a lake or in the ocean with blacked out swim goggles and see how everybody swims on camera. So be on the lookout for that on our YouTube channel. The next time I'm with some tryout coaches, we got to try that one for sure. That sounds like a blasty blast. Big swim problem number 7 is getting a good, comfortable fit from our wetsuit. Wetsuits have to fit just right so they can work with our body and not against our body. Many people said they struggle to find the right one and then they struggle to swim well in it. Coaches, would you please solve our wetsuit woes? Will, over to you first.
Cool. Well, look, I've been working with various wetsuit brands for years, decades, too long. What we've actually found over the years is that, again, going back to that metric of 85% of particularly middle and long distance swimmers, triathletes, not coming from a swim background, a lot of pro athletes don't really know how to fit the wetsuit even. Now, this is obviously changing over the years. But, you know, even the big gun open water 10,000 meter swimmers from the Olympics, up until a few years ago, didn't know how to do it, even though they were specialists in open water, because the wetsuit wasn't allowed. They had to be skins, basically. Well, and a costume of some description. You know, so it is a little bit of an art. Fitting a wetsuit well, I think we've got a little video which we can pop into the link for this podcast.
Yeah, but, you know, I love it.
Ideally, it's a two-person job. It is hard to do well on your own, but if you fit it well, like I can fit into a suit that is like, on the sizing scale, 9 kilos too small for me, right? If I fit it well. And actually, the closer the fit is, the better the technology within the suit is going to work, to a point, obviously. And then, you know, one of the issues that we see quite often is that it comes down to the quality of the neoprene. So the thing called Yamamoto rubber, which basically will stretch around about 5 times its size outside of the seams. But that only starts at a certain price point. And I'm not trying to spend people's money for them, right? Because particularly if you're getting into sport, you need to do what you've got to do. But if you're an adult, which for most part, triathletes are really heavily in that sort of demographic, you're not wildly going to change in shape. So unless you're on some sort of fitness journey, but once you get to the shape where you're happy and you think you're going to roughly be, you know, most wetsuits have quite a wide range in terms of kilos, right? You're not going to get any shorter or taller, so it's only the weight that really fluctuates. So maybe invest in that suit, because in wetsuits, what you pay for is what you get. And the lower quality rubber, the entry-level suits, they do not flex as well, right? So unless you fit those really, really well, then it's going to be a miserable time. I mean, even with the high-quality suits, right, Professor Greg White, who's is quite well-known here in the UK, there's a lot of stuff for charity and so on. Anyway, he's swum the Channel multiple times. He's a physiologist, and he hates swimming it in a wetsuit, even though he's faster in a wetsuit, because the fatigue in his deltoids is horrendous just from the recovery element of the stroke. Now, you put cheap rubber or cheaper rubber into the equation, and that only exacerbates the problem. And of course, you do a long course, it makes it worse. So, you know, think about what your budget is, because like I say, you're not going to change shape. Treat it well and it'll treat you well.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And I when Jan Sibbersen, our good friend from Selfish Wetsuits, was on the podcast, he made a really interesting point that I don't think as customers we think about, but he was like, ask us. Like if you have a question about like what size wetsuit you should be in, like we know our products. So whatever brand you're looking at, whatever model you're eyeballing, reach out to the brand. Don't be afraid to ask. They're more than happy to help you get the right size. And to Will's point, Will and Rhea have a video where they teach you how to put on a wetsuit the proper way with two people. We're going to put that link in the description for you to check out how they do it. Coach Joe, anything to add there about wetsuits?
I do think on the female front, there is more change to body as we talk about, you know, leading up to Ironman. My physique changes, you know, and again, it comes back to practicing in that wetsuit and asking. I love what you said, Andrew, about asking the company, you know, reaching out to them, you know, their customer service. Most of them are so willing to help you find what is a good fit for you. You know, I'm a weird fit, small, tall, and it's still short on me. People constantly ask, did you cut that wetsuit at the bottom? No, I didn't cut the wetsuit at the bottom. It just comes right below the knee. But you know that wetsuits are, if you read in their description or ask their customer service, for those that are more natural swimmers, grew up swimming, collegiate swimmers, they're going to want a different type of wetsuit. Different wetsuits are made differently. Yeah. Different brands are made differently. You know, for those that want more buoyancy, that have their legs, hips, feet drop, then, you know, they are going to want a wetsuit that provides more buoyancy. A more natural swimmer, no, that's going to fight against the stroke that, you know, that they've always had. So I think it's super important to ask. You know, ask the customer service, ask training partners, which they prefer. Try it out. You know, if it doesn't work for you, most of the companies will take it back. You know, but it's very important to not wait up until morning of the race. And then it takes you 2.5 hours to get the wetsuit on and you're fully sweated wet. That's not a good sign. So make sure you've practiced.
That shouldn't be your warm up.
No, make sure you've practiced putting it on. That's another thing to do.
Actually, to that point, like, you always see this in transition, right? People rushing to put their suits on. It's the one part of the race you don't need to rush, right?
Yeah.
So do it slowly, do it properly, take your time. Like, you see it every time. People have been meticulous about taking a blade of grass off their wheel or something. but then they were rushing, hopping down onto the swim course, trying to get themselves into a suit. Of course, they're going to have a bad experience.
Yeah, it's one thing to keep in mind too is when you first put that wetsuit on. I mean, see how that wetsuit feels in the water, because they should fit you. They're designed to fit you well in a horizontal plane in water. So mine, when I first put it on, it feels tight. And then as soon as I lay horizontally in water and start swimming, it no longer feels tight. So keep that in mind as well. You know, clock a few laps and see how you feel. Big swim problem number 9 is swim-specific body pains. There's a couple things that our athletes reported that they don't experience from cycling and running that is unique to the swim. Some folks reported calf muscles that cramp just every swim, 45, 15 minutes into a pool session. No matter what, my calves start cramping. Some folks reported their eye sockets are hurting by the end of a one-hour workout from their goggles and that seal. And some folks reported shoulder pain from just the grind of lap after lap. I personally have experienced all three of those in different phases of my triathlon career. How can we thwart some of these common swim-specific body pains? Coach Will.
Well, so yeah, calf muscles is super common. We get that quite a lot. Whether you know we're kicking or not, our upper bodies are dominant in the requirement for blood whilst swimming. In a pool, we're effectively doing a weighted jump every time we push off, right? With limited blood supply, replenishing the muscles. It's a CP, or creatine phosphate energy system. It's explosive and takes a while to regenerate, like 3 to 5 minutes. So it's certainly not in the time it's taking you to swim another 25 meters. But we're doing an aerobic activity, and so it takes absolute beating with the limited blood supply. But honestly, the fitter you get, the more often you swim, you'll notice this problem dissipating. So like, for example, if I've been out of swimming for a little while and I start getting a little bit of a cramp towards the back end of the set, maybe 3,000 meters in, 2,500 to 3,000 meters in, then as you get fitter, you know, I've pushed out to a 7,000-8,000 meter swim set and I've had no cramp at all. But all the build-up through the weeks up to that, it's been coming later and later and later until the point where it no longer matters, because you're swimming your distance without any issues. So my advice is, look, stick with it.
And that will, I just want to say that exactly mirrors my experience with that problem, because that's a problem I have almost every single session. My calves will start cramping. And as I was getting ready for Ironman, all of a sudden, you know, you're in the pool more regularly it starts happening later and later in the set to where it just stops happening altogether. So definitely agree with you there.
So goggles. Honestly, smaller goggles as a rule, which is not, you know, necessarily a popular opinion, are better. They're better fit. You know, your vision's maybe not quite as good as a wider goggle, but it fits your eye socket better, because most people's skulls are different, which means it's harder to create a seal, but most people's eye sockets are quite similar. There's a little bit of a difference with coming to the bridge of the nose. I have a big nose bridge, and consequently, it's important for me to be able to switch out from the generic nose piece that comes with the goggles, right? And most of the goggles that come outside of your face, you can't adjust the nose piece. They tend to be molded. So if you are having a problem with a good fit on your goggle, step away from the single mold goggle and look for something that you can have an adjustable nose piece, something like that. But it is very, very personal. My particular brand, I won't do the brand, but my particular model that I've been using for years, I can actually take the straps off, put them onto my eyes, and do a sprint 50 with a tumble turn.
Wow.
And, you know, now that's not going to happen for everyone. But what I'm saying is trial and error. You know, it is, they aren't cheap necessarily, but maybe you can swap some goggles with your mates to get a good idea of what's a good option for you. If your wallet's looking pretty fat this month, then maybe look at some of the 3D printed ones that you can get now. But do be aware that they are no more durable than a cheap pair. So, you know, you're setting yourself up, if they're wonderful, for extended expenses. That sounds a lot like triathlon. And then finally, shoulder pain. As long as it's not from poor technique, which it might be. So a really common issue for shoulder pain, particularly like you'll find it right on top of the shoulder joint where the sort of end of the shoulder girdle, which is your rotator cuff, right? And it can be from a thumb entry. We see this from swim teaching 80s, 90s and noughties, where people enter with a thumb and doing this like, they used to call it like a half keyhole shape to their stroke, and that puts a lot of pressure on the shoulder, and it can be really detrimental. And actually, some people end up with surgery. Don't do it.
Wow.
So you know, correct technique. But if it's not that, then we're talking about your normal recovery methods, right? Good balance of protein in the diet, 2 grams per kilogram of body weight, good cool down, right? Just because the main set's over, you know, don't rush out the pool. I know time is always tight, but use the cool down. Even there's a lot of science suggesting that a really hot shower, extended shower after a swim workout is good for helping dissipate the waste products. Some light stretching, infrared clothing, you know, making sure that it's not one of those brands that just coat it with infrared, but they actually have it imparted the molten resin stage, like Chimera do that. Pool standing. Pool standing is really, really effective. It looks a bit weird, but it's really good. Basically, you just need to stand there with your head above the water, as long as your neck is covered, and it raises your heart rate by about 10%. Again, human reaction to water. But it's great because what you're trying to do with recovery is increase the blood flow to the various muscles, so that's super useful. And then just some light active recovery work. But, you know, wear your sore shoulders, providing it's not from injury or from a bad technique, with pride. You know, you put the work in, and you're gonna be massive in your tri-suit.
Joanna and I actually use the same model of goggle.
Don't tell people. Don't tell them.
What was that?
Don't tell them. They're going to buy them. Prices are going to go up.
Joe, there's plenty to go around. And it's funny because it's not a brand that I see very often at triathlon events, but I was watching the last round of the Olympics, and I noticed, like, oh, man, a lot of the American swimmers have arena goggles. I was like, so they got to be good goggles if the Olympians are using them, and they obviously are using the more pool variation, but I was like, let me see if this brand has tri goggles. And sure enough, they did. I ordered a pair, and it's the first one I found that I do not really have leaking problems with. And obviously, to your point, well, everybody's face is different, so those work for Joanna and I. They might leak or not get a good seal on Will. And so you got to find what works for you for sure. I love your idea of swapping with your mates and seeing it just kind of what could work for you before you buy it and spend a lot of money. But anyway, Joe, anything to add there on those three kind of pain problems that Will just walked us through?
The one thing I find with a lot of my athletes is vision problems. So as much as we want a smaller, I do agree with Will. I think there's some better fit as far as some of the smaller types of goggles. A lot of my athletes, a lot of them are older, struggle with sighting and vision. And I have found that the arena that we use, it's impeccable. I mean, they are amazing sighting, and they're an anti-fog, which is awesome too. If you can find a one swipe goggle that you can, whatever product you tend to use, once you've cleaned them and start the race, they're not fogging up on you. That's huge. I mean, it all comes back to, if we can't see, that's unnerving, and that's, and then we're off course and we're nervous and our heart rate goes up and we're not comfortable. So I think it's very important, as Will was saying, is that, you have to find what works for you, and you need to practice in those goggles in open water, and make sure that, you don't have any issues with them.
Yep, I just pulled it up to confirm the name. Joanna and I use the Arena Cobra.
Cobra Tri-Swipe.
Triathlon.
Yeah.
Goggles. Yep. And they are great. They're actually on sale right now.
Oh.
So anyway, go check those out. Big swim problem number 10 is not improving in the water and being unable to identify why. Swimming is so technique based. Fitness improvements can only help so much. How can a triathlete get unstuck in their swim improvement? Coach Joe, what do you think?
I'm going to make y'all repeat this statement. I have my athletes. This is the holy grail of swimming. There has to be proper form before fitness. There has to be form before fitness. I get a lot of athletes that come to me talking about, that they, that they're just stuck. They're plateaued. Three things we have to know. Three things are truth. We have to find proper body position in the water. We have to find balance. We have to reduce resistance. That is how you're going to be a faster swimmer. You could swim 50,000 yards a week and be perpetrating bad stroke, bad habits. You're never going to get faster. So, I have athletes that come out of pool school, and the coach's orders, I'll say, I want you for 12 swim sessions to do the pool school drill sequence. I want you to drill for the prescribed time the entire time. I want it to become your norm. The tricky thing about establishing great form, reducing resistance, getting very comfortable with a fast stroke. It's hard to learn that in the water. It's much easier to learn body position and balance if we're in a very stable environment, meaning we're on the dry land. You know, if we can take away breathing, if we can take away all of the other sensory deprivation that we find in the water and have you establish muscle memory, what your arms are supposed to be doing, how your body is supposed to be rotated, where your head is supposed to be positioned. If that can become ingrained in you on dry land before we put you in the water, you're going to establish good form. And that's going to carry over into the water, and you'll be able to drill and work on it, and that will become your normal stroke, which will be a faster stroke.
Yeah, sounds great. And I know, Joe, for a lot of these questions today, when I was asking, okay, how do you solve this problem? How do you solve that problem? You could have just said, attend Trot-Out Pool School. And so I compliment both of you, Will, as a Trot-Out Pool School instructor yourself over in the UK. Both of you, we could have had this be the fastest podcast ever just by saying, yep, go to Trot-Out Pool School, and it'll solve a lot of these problems for you. So Joe, before we call it a day, I would be remiss if I didn't give you the opportunity to properly plug Trot-Out Pool School as an answer to a lot of these problems. You know, what from this list specifically do you feel like people could really get a handle on just by attending Trot-Out Pool School instead of just fighting for session after session after session on their own?
Well, I think it's, you know, going back to the instructional method. I was a swim instructor for 20 years, and I'm guilty of it. I would have, you know, whether it was a kid or an adult, the way I instructed on swim was always flaw focused. It was always, hey, I see their arm crossing over. Hey, I see their head's too high. And then I would put a Band-Aid on it. I'd give them a drill or something to fix a symptom. But I was never addressing the root cause of what was going on. Their body was not in the right position. They weren't balanced. And when we established Trot-Out Pool School over a year ago, the whole concept was different. It was, we were going to build stroke from the ground up, or I say from the poolside off. We are going to establish the basics of the stroke first. And so it is definitely, we looked at how the body functions, and then we applied form. And that has been a huge difference in how we teach swimming. You have to look at what the root cause of the problem was with a swimmer and not just what a symptom was in their stroke. So it's very innovative. It's a totally different type of instruction. What I mentioned before was there hasn't been an instructional method that said, hey, I need you to do a couple of weeks of dry land exercises. You're like, oh man, I feel like an idiot. I'm on a yoga mat in my house, you know, trying to practice a high elbow and, you know, all the terminology that we use in pool school. We want them to do that work first. They've got to do the work so that they've already established some muscle memory in what their arm looks like when it enters the water. Then they come to our in-person workshop, and we still continue to have them do dry land work, but immediately put them in the water to practice what they've learned. And it absorbs. It gets ingrained in you. It changes your stroke. And that has been, it's been revolutionary. And I will say one more thing, because I have gotten, you know, a lot of comments about, you know, the cost of pool school. We invest astronomical amounts of money in the type of bicycles we ride and in the type of races we do. We're constantly paying race fees and entry fees. If people would invest, it's really just, you know, a percentage of that in their stroke, they would be super happy. The benefits they would see would be, you know, are really crazy across the board.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely an investment in your swim, for sure. And yeah, I think a lot of people see that it's a weekend clinic and think it's a lot for just a weekend of swimming. But to your point, there's weeks of homework leading up to it. There's weeks of follow up on the back end. I think we can tease this. Our software team is working on bringing pool school drills into the app for athletes. Once you go through pool school, your drills in the app will be refined, just kind of knowing how far you advanced in pool school while you were there. So it's definitely buying into a system that is going to overhaul your swimming, as opposed to just, it's not just a 2 days in the water with coaches, which, to be fair, would already be worth quite a bit.
So, the other thing that doesn't really get spoken about as much, it's all about performance, which is great. But actually, we're seeing a huge reduction in anxiety. You know, one of the reasons that people don't go to the pool is because they're nervous to get in the pool. They're anxious to start.
Sure.
And what pool school does is it gives people this toolbox of very easily repeatable drills and a way to rebuild up their stroke. And it takes that anxiety out. And before they know what they're doing, they're swimming. And they're swimming really well. And so it's a super friendly environment. I can't recommend it enough.
Great set, everyone. Let's cool down.
Hello there, everyone. I'm Vanessa, your average triathlete with elite level enthusiasm. And I'm honored to be sitting here with Alex Hamlow, who will be sharing a coach cool down tip. Alex grew up on a cherry ranch in California and is over the top inspirational. He is the president and CEO of Hamlow Servant Leadership, which provides healthcare companies with coaching, systems, and development plans. He is also president and CEO of the Candy Hamlow Memorial Foundation, which launched in 2022 after his wife's passing from cancer. On the triathlon side of things, Alex has been involved in the sport for 37 years, and he has competed in over 150 triathlons and more than 20 ultramarathons. He has sat on top of the 70.3 age group podium. He is a 7-time USAT National Championship age group qualifier, a 70.3 age group qualifier, 30-plus 70.3 finisher, 3-time 140.6 finisher, and many ultramarathon top 3 age group finishes. Alex has been a triathlon coach since 2011 and started coaching with TriDot in 2022. He likes working with slow or fast intermediate and experienced athletes, experienced single sport cyclists and runners looking to get into triathlon, and I can only imagine with all of his racing and coaching experience, he knows a thing or two about nutrition and hydration for endurance sports. Welcome to the cool down, Alex.
Hey, Vanessa, so glad to be here. Can't wait to get into it.
Me too. Something that most people don't know about you is that you previously weighed over 325 pounds, gaining 140 after suffering a brain injury when you were hit by a drunk driver. I'm imagining that this was a life-altering event for you that came with quite the recovery journey.
Yeah, Vanessa, it sure did. I was 9 years plus into the sport. I was thinking, like most people, I was on a ramp, I was invincible. I had actually really got into 70.3 in the last few years and was on my way to Ironman full. And then this event, this tragic thing occurred. I was essentially stuck with the brain injury and unable to raise my heart rate or do anything of any kind of activity without severe consequences to brain swelling. So I gained the weight because I was used to eating. I was an athlete. I was also depressed from not being able to do all those things. You can name all the reasons and all the things, but in the end, it was almost 5 years before I was able to clearly do activity and not actually suffer the consequences of the brain swelling. So it took a year to drop the weight. And within that year, I literally had dropped about 130 pounds and started racing again. And I've been racing ever since. And what's amazing is while it was like starting from scratch when I began to train again, I was able to meet and surpass all the goals that I had set many years before in the sport. And, you know, you heard from the preamble, I'm not done yet. So super excited to share that journey and give people any kind of inspiration that, you know, you got to have grit, you got to have determination, and nothing can stop you if you have those things. And so more power to all those out there that I know have even been through more difficult circumstances. But I'm excited for the journey ahead and so grateful to still be able to do it.
Yes, I fully, fully believe that you are an inspiration to so many people out there. And thank you for being so vulnerable and sharing your story with us. And I'm also excited to hear what tip you have for us today.
Yeah, well, I want to talk a little bit about cycling, handling.
Yay!
with a TT bike. But most importantly, I'm going to actually talk about something that's rarely discussed, and that is low speed handling and avoidance of situations that you're likely to occur when you're in the sport of triathlon. Most people work on bike handling, comfort in the TT position. It's obviously awkward. It's different. I'll just make an assumption and set that aside. That's one thing, obviously, that needs to be worked on. One thing that gets overlooked is that there's two – people even talk, by the way, about mounting and doing all those things. I'm not going to talk about this. What I want to talk about is how do you actually deal with when you have to slow down quickly and you have to deal with some impediment or get around something or a change in the course or what have you. How to practice that is really simple. First of all, what you need to do is find a safe place. Usually a parking lot works really well for this. A morning where it's a parking lot where the businesses aren't open yet, but they have those islands and nice little areas and wide berth and good pavement. And the best thing to do is pick one of those corner islands. And you take the straightaway and you literally take that turn as you would normally take it at whatever comfortable speed you have. Then you do it again at half that speed. And then you do it again at an even slower speed. And once you've mastered the ability to actually make those 90 degree turns both directions at lower and slower speeds, the next thing you're going to do is you're going to actually practice clipping out on your inside foot. And you're going to do the same thing, except you're going to keep the one inside foot unclipped. Because the biggest thing you have to realize is that when you come up upon a situation, you're clipped in your pedals, and all of a sudden you need to slow down, you're going to make a decision whether you're going to have to move to the left or move to the right. You're going to be slowed down at lower speed. Whichever way you're going to have to go, that leg you're going to need to be able to clip out of the pedals so you have ultimate control as you make a low speed turn. You might even need to put your foot down, but you're out of the pedals. You're not going to fall over. You've got to practice pedaling around a corner with one foot clipped in, the outside foot, and one unclipped so that you can balance your body at those low speeds around those tight turns. It will serve you well in just regular circumstances, but more importantly, in a race or in a difficult training situation, you'll have much better control of your bike, your person, and a few less abrasions on your knees, legs, arms, elbows, and yeah, all those right. other buttons.
Yeah, I have one question for you about that. When you take your foot out of the pedal, do you sure. rest your foot on the pedal, like behind where the clip is on your shoe, or do you just keep your leg extended, or how do you do that?
So it's a great question. So when you're going straight, you absolutely rest your foot on the pedal, just unclipped. But as you make that slow speed turn or even medium speed turn, let's say it's to the right, that means your right foot is unclipped. Then you actually let your foot naturally and loosely dangle next to the crank arm. And that way, as you maneuver the bike, your leg will actually naturally be dangling, not dragging on the ground, but not actually interfering with your pedal. And therefore, if you need to put your foot down, it's ready to go, but you're loose and relaxed on that side. So you're not going to just fall over if all of a sudden something happens even further in front of you. So it's just a great tip to practice riding around tight corners like that at lower speeds, both clipped and then unclipped.
Thanks for joining us. Make sure to subscribe and share the TriDot podcast with your triathlon crew. For more great Tri content and community, connect with us on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. Ready to optimize your training? Head to TriDot.com and start your free trial today. TriDot, the obvious and automatic choice for triathlon training.